Have you heard the term silver splitters? Also known as gray divorce. It's a demographic trend of couples over 50 who are ending long-term marriages, separations that often happen after 20 years or more together, and the numbers continue to rise. By one count, since 1990, the divorce rate of people over 50 has doubled. Some research says gray divorces will triple by 2030, and it's a little different than those who separate at a younger age, where issues may be child custody or early career debts. Here we're talking about complex assets, dividing retirement accounts, pensions, Social Security. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry Mueller today on The Larry Mueller Show. In this hour, we're focusing on family law and taking your questions at 1-800-642-1234, regardless of age, 1-800-642-1234. If you have a question about Wisconsin's family law, you can also email us, talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Our expert this hour is Paul Stenzel. He's a collaborative lawyer and mediator with the law firm Hanson & Hildebrand in Milwaukee and is also affiliated with the Family Mediation Center. And Paul, welcome to The Larry Mueller Show.
Thank you, Lee. I appreciate you taking on this topic.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, and I guess it's a statistic that I really did not realize until recently. So tell me a little bit about your work and the kind of cases that you handle.
Yeah, I handle divorce primarily, and I work mostly as a mediator. And that's kind of a good place to start in talking about this topic, because I think a lot of people don't realize they have a choice as far as how to navigate divorce or legal separation. There's kind of a conventional picture, and I've had this story walk into my office sometimes. One spouse goes to a lawyer. They say, I want to get divorced. The lawyer files the papers with the court. Maybe the other spouse gets served at work by a law enforcement officer. And immediately there's kind of an escalation and a lot of upset. And even the original spouse who sought the divorce says, well, I didn't want all that to happen. And so it is good at the beginning to talk about how do you want to navigate divorce, right? There's mediation, working with a neutral third person to come to agreements on your own outside of court. There's collaborative, similar in spirit to mediation, again, committing to a negotiated agreement, but each person has their own lawyer and enters the collaborative process. And then there's kind of conventional representation, right, where one or both spouses hire lawyers, and then the range of everything, negotiation, litigation, is available to them. So, and then, of course, there's do-it-yourself, which has become a lot more popular with the rise of the internet and that. And that has its own pitfalls. But so one of the things that I really focus on in my work is education, and that process choice is a good place to start.
Yeah, so deciding whether or not you want to go through mediation, make it collaborative, go conventional with each side getting an attorney, or dabbling and do it yourself. But how do you decide when the time comes? I mean, in my mind, Paul, emotions are running high. There is contention. There is, you know, the relationship no longer functions. So how do you go about finding a healthy way to decide which way to go about separation?
Yeah, that's a great question. And, you know, the beginning part of that is just this awareness, which is, again, why I'm appreciative of being on here and people being aware there are choices. Some people do their own sorting. And believe it or not, I think contrary to sort of the maybe popular media image that gets built up because of the movies and different things, I find there are a lot of people who simply don't want to be married anymore, but they don't want to go to a big fight for a lot of reasons. And especially in the case of what you mentioned, a little bit of a focus on gray divorce, there are a lot of long-standing relationships when people have been married for a long time. And not just with children, and including adult children, including in-laws. You know, an in-law may say, well, I'm not getting a divorce, right? So it is thinking about how do you want to restructure your family and these other things. And so that will inform the process choice to some extent. I think people who have been married a long time have more an investment of saying, you know what, we're going to be joined together if they have kids, which many people do. we're going to be joined together by our children. We want to be able to go to our children's college graduation, our child's wedding, perhaps, or other milestone events. And that will inform saying, hey, let's try to do this collaboratively or in mediation. Of course, those choices are not for everyone. And I'm not suggesting that everyone will choose the same thing. Just be aware there is a choice.
So, Paul, if there is an amicable split after a long-term marriage, how does one make the decision between mediation and collaboration?
Yeah, good question also. A mediation is a little bit more working with one lawyer, right? So I often work with people who otherwise are representing themselves, right? When I work as a neutral, I'm not representing them. I'm guiding them. I'm providing education. I'm facilitating the process. That's for people who can work together well enough, right? At the end of the relationship, this is maybe one last significant working together in the interest, again, of moving through it without escalation, without making things any more difficult than they already are. And I say to people, of course, divorce is difficult under even the best circumstances. Collaborative divorce, where each person has their own lawyer, might be for someone who is maybe feeling a little less confident in some aspect of the situation. Sometimes we see it with knowledge about the finances of the marriage. You know, if one person has done all of the financial handling during the marriage, maybe the other spouse is feeling a little bit uncertain or uneasy about that. That might be a situation where, you know, each person having their own lawyer might be a little more beneficial. It can be different things. I mean, certainly, you know, in situations where there are additional stressors, there may be drug or alcohol issues or even domestic abuse or violence. Those are cases where sometimes a person is going to need to have, or will be better served, I should say, by having their own lawyer.
And so this is sort of, I guess, colored by the new season of couples therapy streaming now, where I watch, you know, a neutral therapist in a reality show dealing with couples who often can feel like even while the therapist is being neutral, they can feel attacked or they're feeling like they're getting the short end of the stick in this. How, as a mediator, do you handle those sorts of emotions which can still rise even while people are amicably trying to find a way out of their long-term relationships, Paul?
Yeah, that can be very challenging. I am a lawyer, right, by training, and I admire my mental health colleagues for the tools that they use, and I try to learn from them on how to move through difficult emotional issues that do come up, certainly, in my work. And usually the way that I'm dealing with those things are to give it some acknowledgement, to have some communication about it. But obviously, I am not skilled or trained in helping people with those things. I certainly can connect them with resources. This is a good time for me to mention, too, that when parents of minor children get divorced, I connect them with a person that we call a child and family specialist, who is a mental health professional who works with the parents on a parenting plan. They are the child and family specialist is also trained as a mediator. So they're not diagnosing. They're not doing a long-term intervention. They're helping the parents reach a co-parenting agreement, which is important for two reasons. One, it addresses custody and placement of their minor children, which is required by law. The second reason that's as important, or almost more important in some cases, is that they talk to the parents about how are you going to co-parent together and dealing with those non-legal issues. For example, one that comes up at the beginning of the process very often, how do we talk to our children about divorce? And the mental health professional can be so helpful because remember, parents only get one chance to do that, to sit down with their child or children and talk about, break the news to them. This is what's happening. I've had many parents work with a child and family specialist on creating that plan, how to do that. So those folks, those child and family specialists can really help, you know, because they swim in those emotional waters very well.
And unlike a therapist, you have the statutes of Wisconsin, you have codified law that you can point to that says this is the way it is. It's the way the book's written.
Yeah, to some extent. I mean, the reality is that the statutes provide a very important framework. There are a lot of presumptions. The fact of the matter is, if husband and wife, or if spouses, reach their own agreements, the courts are pretty good about approving families' own agreements, right? So you have quite a wide berth within the framework of the statutes.
Before we get to your calls for our guest, Paul Stenzel, family mediator and attorney at 1-800-642-1234 or talk at WPR.org. I can hear it in your voice, your passion for your work, Paul, but what do you love about it? Because, again, as the traditional media paints it, as some relations fall apart, it seems contentious, it seems emotional, it seems, you know, dangerous, but what's rewarding and what do you love about the work you do here?
Yeah, part of it is that really being able to help people in a difficult time. I realized a long time ago, almost 20 years ago, when I first took some mediation training, that I felt naturally attuned to it. I'm able to let the difficulties and the conflict kind of wash over me like a river going over a rock, maybe. And so I realized that I had some natural affinity and natural ability in this area. And it is very, you know, very trying for people, and it's very rewarding. And I get feedback from people often that say, you know what, I didn't want to do this. It is very difficult, but, you know, Paul, you and your team, you know, made it much better than they thought it was going to be. And so it is that basic idea of really helping people in a difficult time, that it doesn't have to be so difficult and so bleak necessarily.
And also sounds like you have a certain sense of zen about it all as well.
That I do. That helps. That helps. I am a meditator also, in addition to being a mediator. So
yeah, I can hear that the way you explain it. Paul Stenzel, our guest, collaborative attorney and mediator with the law firm Hansen and Hildebrand, also affiliated with the Family Mediation Center, taking your calls at 1-800-642-1234 or emails at talk@wpr.org. Mark in Green Bay, good morning.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Let's just put it, a friend of mine is separated. His spouse is having an affair, and also they're having problems with their 16-year-old daughter, who's also having sex, which is, both of these things I believe are against the law. And yet being separated, it's difficult. The one guy, he doesn't really want to get a divorce. He's deeply religious, committed, and doesn't want this. But the difference here is this: there are statutes that say, I believe, that a spouse can't have sex with somebody other than their spouse in Wisconsin. And 16-year-old girls are not supposed to have sex, even if it's with another 16-year-old. That's against the law too, isn't it?
Well, let's ask an attorney, Paul.
There's a lot to, sorry, I don't mean to laugh. That is very serious. And there's a lot to unpack there, though. And I know that can be frustrating. There are statutes on both of those things that the caller mentioned. I haven't looked at the adultery statute in a long time. I'm not aware that gets very frequently, if ever at all, prosecuted in Wisconsin, but prosecutors have a lot of discretion on those kinds of situations.
So there is adultery on the books in the Wisconsin state law?
I haven't looked in a long time. I'm glad you said that, because I'm not 100% sure. I assume that it was, but I haven't had this question come up, Lee.
Interesting.
In my vast practice, so I would have to say it's always good to check the statutes. As far as 16-year-olds, that I am more familiar with, and that it is on the books. And again, there's a lot of variation in terms of prosecutorial discretion. You know, is a 16-year-old having sex with a peer versus someone older? That raises a lot of issues. But the caller also sparked something in my mind that I wrote down and want to just touch on, which is communication. And, you know, I know people at times, like the caller's describing, are not getting along. One thing that I find is that a lot of the issues that come up for people are not so much legal issues. Can I do this, or should I, or may I? There may be some legal answers to those. The issue, though, is if you do that, what is that going to mean for your spouse and your family? And so often I'm saying to people, issues that you have are going to be resolved by the two of you communicating and making a plan, as opposed to just saying, well, I'm legally allowed to do this. And then it, you know, can create and escalate things.
Mark, thank you so much for the call, because it brings up another point that I think, you know, bears sort of fleshing out here. And that is the difference between civil and criminal law.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, when I'm in my realm of family law, it is almost exclusively civil. I mean, there are some things, there's a few things here and there, but they rarely come up. And then the caller did mention things, yes, that were, if adultery is still on the books, that would be a criminal violation. And certainly children under the age of 18 having sex, I know that there are statutes, you know, forbidding that. Again, how often they're prosecuted, though, is another question.
So a quick Google search here shows that adultery technically is still a crime in Wisconsin. However, whether or not it is prosecuted ends up being up to law enforcement, I would imagine, and not civil attorneys.
Yeah, that sounds right to me. I hadn't heard anything lately that they had taken it off the books, but I do think a lot of people think of it as pretty much dead letter.
Yeah. Paul Stenzel, our guest, attorney and mediator with the law firm Hansen and Hildebrand in Milwaukee, also with a family mediation center, and we'll ask him about that work when we continue. And continue with your questions as well at 1-800-642-1234 or email us, talk@wpr.org. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry Mueller today, and you are listening to The Larry Mueller Show. Larry Mueller is going to be live from Bayfield and Bloom on a week from Friday. That's a week from tomorrow already. Jeez. And if you would like to attend, I think there is a wait list you can sign up for at wpr.org/presents. Garden Talk Live from Bayfield and Bloom from 11 to 1 next Friday. And you can get on the waiting list if you would if you're going to be in town or are already there. Also, we still have some tickets available, surprisingly enough, to the Barrymore in Madison to see Larry Mueller live at 7 o'clock Wednesday, June 3rd. That's coming up as well. And get your tickets before they're gone. They are all free. We just ask that you register so we know how many people to expect and so we can welcome you when you come. If you get shut out of all that, Larry Mueller is going to be throwing out the first pitch Sunday, June 14th at the Madison Mallards game at the Duck Pond. And you just need to buy a ticket to admission there. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today. And our guest is Paul Stenzel, a collaborative lawyer and mediator with law firm Hansen and Hildebrand, also affiliated with the Family Mediation Center. And Paul, I am interested in your work with the Family Mediation Center in Milwaukee. What's your role there and what's the center do?
Yeah, that is established about 10 years ago now. And the idea was to give people another option in terms of how, again, they navigate divorce. I work there as a mediator. We work exclusively with parties who are representing themselves. So they come to me and they work with me as in my role as a lawyer mediator. And the reason that's a distinction representing themselves is there are some mediations that also occur where people already have lawyers. So sometimes we call that lawyer assisted mediation, and that's a different type of mediation. And so the Family Mediation Center was meant to create that option kind of in the middle in terms of giving people a place so that they don't have to just try and do it themselves, right, which has got its own issues, and they don't have to necessarily go out and hire two lawyers and lay down two retainers, right, which can be quite expensive. So it's meant to try and find that space, because what we found historically is from 20 or 25 years ago, the numbers are almost inverted in terms of how many or how people are hiring lawyers. So it was 20 or 25 years ago, 2/3 to 3/4 of people getting divorced hired lawyers. And now those numbers are inverted. Huh. And so that's for probably a lot of different reasons, not the least of which is the internet, kind of do it yourself. I'm guilty of that too, right? I can change my garbage disposal and watch a YouTube video and then And then
you got garbage halfway, everywhere.
Yeah, well, and halfway through, I say I should have hired a plumber. So there's some of that, and there's other reasons, I think. So this mediation that is growing is really a way to say to folks who otherwise were not hiring lawyers, hey, you can benefit from some professional help, and it won't cost you as much, because hiring one lawyer is certainly cheaper than hiring two.
Well, Paul, that brings us to the expectations of cost when it comes to a divorce. And you'd mentioned that there are generally four types of processes you could use for a divorce: mediation, like the Family Mediation Center without attorneys; collaborative, which has attorneys working together; conventional, which is more contentious, and DIY, which is more like trying to replace a garbage disposal with a YouTube video, or generally speaking. How do you assess these costs, and to what role do you see them playing in people's decisions about how to go about separations?
Yeah, yeah. So interestingly, you might think I would say, well, do-it-yourself is going to end up being the least costly. And in some ways, of course, it is if you don't hire someone. But a lot of times people can end up either, you know, hitting the kind of the procedures of the courts and having to go to multiple court hearings. So now they're taking time off of work. If they make a mistake in their paperwork and don't do something correctly, it can cost more later. So even though do it yourself, people would think, well, yeah, that's the cheapest. You've got to be a little careful, right? Mm-hmm. And then kind of going up from there, I think mediation is traditionally usually going to be less than conventional representation. Again, as I mentioned, hiring one lawyer. And also, it is true that most people that find their way to me and to us are relatively amicable. And when people are amicable and they have a pretty good idea of what they want to do, or if they don't agree on everything, they're willing to talk it through, that saves time and money, right? And so then I'm putting together their agreements, pointing different things out. And then collaborative practice is going to be maybe a little bit more, right? Each person hiring their own lawyer, but still less than full-blown litigation because you're staying out of court. Court is very costly. It costs a lot of time and money for lawyers to prepare for court, to be ready. Everything they have to do, the information they have to understand, the time they have to put in, then going to court itself. So collaborative is less than full-blown litigation, but certainly probably a little bit more than mediation. And then, you know, hiring a lawyer and litigating, so full-on litigation, going to a trial in front of a judge, which, by the way, is very rare. People should know, again, I think the media creates a misimpression. It's only about 3-5% divorces in Wisconsin actually go to a trial in front of a judge. And so that can be quite expensive, preparing for that, all the grind that can occur in a litigation setting. So that would be the most expensive. That easily sometimes can be tens of thousands of dollars.
Oh, wow. So we started our conversation, Paul, looking at gray divorces, those couples over 50 generally considered to have been married for 20 years or more together. And the numbers that seem to suggest those sorts of divorces are going up. Is that been your anecdotal experience in your roles?
I do see a fair amount of those. I think it would, I don't really track in terms of the demographics, but I mean, yes, anecdotally, I would say yes. I see a lot of that. I'm just hedging a little bit because I don't have statistics in terms of our firm's work or the demographics. But anecdotally, yes.
What do you see as the differences between younger couples divorcing and older couples divorcing?
Yeah, a lot of potential differences. Mm-hmm. One of the things with older couples, as I think I mentioned, is just the investment in terms of the relationships and all of those longstanding and the longstanding web of relationships. So it's not just them and their children; it's in-laws. It's, are you thinking also about grandchildren?
Oh,
right. Which is obviously not in the picture yet for some people, but for some it is. And so how is that going to work, right? So those are differences. I mean, the assets and debt division, you know, can have its own complications. You mentioned, you know, if there are complicated financial assets, that certainly can be an issue. The other issue that comes up, and this is kind of a general issue in all cases, but can be in gray divorce, is, you know, going from one household to two is more expensive.
Yes.
And so there's often going to be some financial hardship or even sacrifice. And I think sometimes people don't always think that through, and that can be a little bit of a rude moment. And a lot of times I say to people, you know, connect with your own individual financial planner, because those people are great at, okay, here's what your settlement from the divorce is going to look like. Here's your income. And they can talk to you. And I've seen those folks do that, right? They're good at that. They're good at the numbers, good at the money. How is this going to work for the rest of your near term and longer term planning?
So for a younger marriage that is looking for a legal separation, there may be the issue of child custody, but it sounds like for older couples with complicated assets or retirement accounts, who's going to get custody of the financial planner may be an issue.
Yes, well, I will certainly give out more than one name and encourage them to talk to different people. But
perhaps they already have a financial planner, and unwinding these assets to find a way to divide them, you know, in a fair way between the two. You know, certainly a financial planner would come into play there, especially one that already knows about what kind of assets they hold.
Absolutely. And those folks can be very helpful. And sometimes I, you know, connect with those folks to talk about the very points that you're raising, and understanding what the options are for informed decision making, understanding everything that they've got. So there's transparency for both spouses. Yes, those folks can be very helpful, because there can be very technical questions about taxes, for example, if you liquidate.
Sure.
A brokerage account. Okay, what is there? Is there going to be any tax on the gain? How much is it going to be? What's another way we can do this for tax planning? There's all kinds of ways that those folks can be very helpful with financial questions.
I understand you spent 7 years as a deputy family court commissioner in Racine County. What was that experience like, and how does that inform your work today?
Yeah, I did. Well, it's actually really interesting. It's one place where I started to learn, first of all, to be in that third party role.
Yeah.
I mean, being in the role of a judicial officer is not the same as a mediator, but somewhat similar, right? You're not taking the side of either person. I also really worked a lot. Racine County was big enough that we had several family case calendars going at once. And I would work on the self-represented calendar. We would put all the people who didn't have lawyers on one calendar. And I actually like, some people don't like that. I liked working with those folks, and I learned how to talk to them, how to educate them, how to answer their questions, how to try and diffuse things, you know, where I could. So that was a part of my work that really informed, again, what I mentioned earlier, that I felt I had some natural ability, some natural affinity for sort of being in the midst of conflict without getting, you know, carried away by it.
So those folks who came to you while you were the deputy family court commissioner in Racine County, those were the folks who were doing it themselves?
Well, yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
They were. They, and yes, in a whole variety of ways. And that was where I started to learn about why people were doing it by themselves. And actually, this is, I think, an interesting point. Sometimes I would ask people, you know, when they were concluding their divorce, you know, I'm curious, why didn't you hire lawyers? And they say, oh, we're not fighting at all.
Huh.
And I think that this, again, is a bit of a misperception. And I understand that. And again, I think advertising, different things can portray lawyers as combative and fighting. And there is a role for that. And people see that for family and they say, oh, we don't want that. What is important to know, and I say to people, when you work with me as a mediator, it doesn't mean you have to come in and that you've agreed on everything. There's room within the mediation process for disagreement. And if there is a disagreement, What it means when you're in mediation is you will subject that disagreement to the mediation process. We will talk about it. I will provide a space for you to have an informed, structured conversation, right? That's in contrast to court. If you disagree on something and you are in a court-based process, you are going to be in a courtroom in front of a judicial official, likely with lawyers or without lawyers, arguing about that issue. And then the judicial official, after taking all of that in, applying the law, exercising the fair amount of discretion they have, then that person imposes a decision. So very different and very important to understand those two processes, right? Mediation, working with the mediator, reaching your own agreement, which may be difficult. I'm not saying mediation's a panacea for everything. It means you're within a specific process. And if you're in a court process, subjecting that disagreement or submitting it, I should say, to the judicial official who will then make a decision. And then you have to live with that decision.
What are some other blind spots that people come to the table with when it's time to seek a divorce?
Well, there are a lot. I think one area is a bit of a misunderstanding about premarital property. Sometimes people think, oh, well, I came into the marriage with this, whatever it is, this money, this asset, and therefore it's mine and it's not subject to this, any of this. And that's not true. There are only two exceptions to property being excluded in a divorce. One of them is if people had a prenuptial agreement or a postnuptial agreement, but most people don't have a prenuptial or postnuptial agreement. But that is one way to sort of opt out of the regular family law rules, right? And the second exemption is anything that either spouse received by gift or inheritance before or during the marriage and kept separate from their marital assets. So those are the only exclusions. So when people get married, on the day they get married, other than those two exceptions, everything that they own or owe, so all of their assets and all of their debts and everything they accumulate during the marriage is a part of their divisible marital estate, again, subject to those two exceptions. So I think sometimes people think, oh, well, I had a whole bunch of retirement and I earned that before we got married. That is in the marital estate until for some reason it's out, right? So it starts in. And so I think that is a little bit of a blind spot and a misperception about things. And usually when people hear from me and it's explained and we kind of go through it, they can understand it. And I will also say that within mediation that spouses can have their own agreements about that. I have spouses who come to me and say, you know what, we're each keeping our own premarital retirement. And as long as they've heard the education from me, that's fine. They can make that choice and the court will approve it. And so there's a lot of room for doing your own thing within, you know, mediation and within making agreements.
But how would you keep those pre-marriage assets separate? Does it mean keeping it in a separate account with only your name on it? Does it mean keeping it away from the, if it is an actual property, keeping it apart from the family property?
Yeah, I mean, that's where there are a lot of gradations. I mean, certainly those two that you mentioned are examples where it would be more likely to be viewed as kept separate. You know, where it gets more difficult is, and this comes up, right? Someone says, well, we used $20,000 gift from my parents for part of our down payment on the house. Again, you know, the law is going to say, well, the character of that money starts to change when you use it for a marital purpose. Mm-hmm. Now, is it a black and white thing? It's not. And this is where lawyers can argue. And again, this is where I say to folks, we can talk about that in mediation. Yeah, spouses may not see eye to eye on that. I will share with them, this is what the law says about that, and then we'll talk about it. But there are a lot of ways, and you named two of them, that things can be kept separate. Certainly keeping money in an account with only your name on it and not touching it, you know, creates a strong set of facts for saying That money is individual and not subject to being divided in the divorce.
The other one I was thinking in my mind, you mentioned the contribution for a down payment on a home, but I was thinking of like if it was a classic car that one of the spouses had always had and wanted to keep separate, they'd have to keep it in a separate garage or a storage facility with their own name on it. I was just thinking of, you know, things.
Yeah. I mean, that's right. I mean, remember, though, it's not just being separate. It's that it was gifted or inherited. Right. So,
OK.
Yeah. So anyway, it's important because some people, again, think, well, this was mine. You know, I right. way before I met my spouse, this was mine. And it's like, well, it's not that simple.
Yeah. Marriage will change a property. Paul Stenzel is our guest, collaborative attorney and mediator with law firm Hansen and Hildebrand in Milwaukee. He also works with the Family Mediation Center, and he's answering your questions about Wisconsin's family law at 1-800-642-1234 or email us talk@wpr.org. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry Mueller today, and you're listening to The Larry Mueller Show. Coming up next hour on The Larry Mueller Show, the editor of Big River Magazine, Reggie McLeod, joins us once again with a new issue out now and a lot to talk about up and down the Mississippi as well as through the Driftless. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today, and right now we're talking to Paul Stenzel, a collaborative lawyer and mediator with law firm Hansen and Hildebrand in Milwaukee, also affiliated with the Family Mediation Center in Milwaukee. And if you have family law questions, we're here to take them, 1-800-642-1234. Or email us talk@wpr.org. And Paul, you had mentioned grandchildren earlier. And you talk about child custody, but what legal rights do grandparents have to see their grandchildren? And how does that change when it comes to divorce?
Yeah. So this is an area of the law that is had been changing lately. There was a major Wisconsin Supreme Court decision that came down in the last few years that basically pretty severely curtailed what we call third party visitation rights. It's quite limited in terms of a grandparent's actual legal rights if the parents won't, you know, permit them to see the child. It's the door's not completely closed, but it's very difficult. And again, another reason for people to be thinking thoughtfully, try to think thoughtfully, even though things are very intense in the moment, you know, a relationship is ending that someone thought was going to be the rest of their life and everything that goes with that. And I know people are in turmoil, they're vulnerable, you know, as best they can, if they can start to think about some of those future things, it can really help their children, you know, help that larger, like I said, that larger web of connections.
Yeah, I just from my own personal experience, I can't imagine what life would have been. I am who I am in large part because of both my grandparents and what they taught me. And if you take one of those away, I would not have grown up to be the same guy I am today. So that is that's relatively new.
Yeah, relatively new. And, you know, that's a great example. I mean, those relationships are so enriching and so important.
Absolutely. We've got a call here from RC in DeForest. We'll go to her next. RC, good morning.
Good morning. Two questions, and one is just a clarifying question. The first question is, does legal separation always need to have an endpoint? Like, can a couple be legally separated forever without it ending in divorce? And the second question is, in the state of Wisconsin, because it's a marital property law, a couple can do mediation if they're able to communicate. It doesn't have to end. Like, a couple doesn't need to liquidate all of their assets and split it 50-50 if they do the mediation route.
Yeah, so let me touch on both of those. Legal separation, I should just give a second on that, Lee, because we haven't covered that,
yeah.
Right? So just real quickly, legal separation and divorce are very similar, and their paths overlap 99%. At the end of a divorce, the court dissolves the marriage. At the end of a legal separation, It does not dissolve the marriage, but otherwise has done all of the same things. So there will be orders by the court on asset and debt division, custody and placement. That legal separation stays in place for a year unless there's mutual agreement by both spouses to convert it to a divorce. After 1 year, either spouse can unilaterally convert it to a divorce. And this caller is asking about, is there an endpoint? I am not aware of that. I have not seen that in the statute. I've never been asked that question. As I sit here today, my understanding would be that you could stay permanently, so to speak, legally separated, and it would not have to convert. The second question was about, in the state of Wisconsin, due to marital property law, I think she was asking, does it have to be a 50-50 division, I think was the question,
right.
Is how I understood it. And so it does not, is the short answer. Wisconsin statutes provide a presumption, meaning a starting point of a 50-50 division. The parties by agreement can agree to something else. The further they deviate from 50-50, the more scrutiny there may be from the approving court official. And I mean, like, if it's 80-20 or 90-10, the court is going to ask, hey, even though you're agreeing, why is this so unequal? And I have done unequal property divisions rarely to that extreme, but as long as we explain it to the court and there's a good reason for it, the court will approve it.
Great calls, RC, and thank you so much for joining the show. We'll go to Bonnie in Fitchburg next. Bonnie, good morning.
Hi, how are you? Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
So I went through a kind of traumatic divorce. The person that I, this is years ago. My question is, so I am now, I went back to school and became a licensed psychotherapist. And I also am a Wisconsin collaborative mental health coach, took the training for that, and a child specialist. And I believe in the collaborative and in you know, trying to help people come to agreement. My question is, something that I've recently been trained in and am now working in a nonprofit with both attorneys, guardian ad litem, psychotherapists, regarding when one of the parties is using coercive control, narcissistic abuse, not physical abuse. I find that the family court system, and this is across the country, don't wind up dealing with that very well, can wind up harming actually the person that is been in an abusive marriage.
So we're looking at mental health issues and the roles that that can play in when it comes to divorce, Paul.
Yes, we are. And just to pick up on what Bonnie was saying, first of all, those situations where there's coercive control, sometimes referred to as domestic abuse and maybe violence and abuse, they're very difficult regardless of the process, right? I mean, and I agree with Bonnie, the courts struggle with those. I've had cases where there's an element of that and been working with them as a mediator. It has to be handled very carefully. There has to be a lot of training for everyone involved so that they're understanding those dynamics. They're difficult cases no matter what. Mm. I do think some of those cases in a collaborative or a mediation setting can also work, but they're very challenging.
Yeah, for somebody who has who is maybe a victim of domestic violence, is there protection for them in this process?
Absolutely. And that's something where I, as a mediator, do a lot of screening at the front end. So I'm trying to uncover that if it's present. And then I'm structuring the process in a way to make sure that, right, the person is not put in a bad situation where they're agreeing to something only out of intimidation or retaliation. I will add quickly, there's been a bit of a change, I think, within the domestic abuse community, at least folks that I've heard from, where it used to be thought of as mediation is not appropriate for those cases at all. There's been some shift in thinking of that, don't take away another choice from a domestic abuse victim, right? If they think mediation can work for them, respect that choice. Like I said, though, these cases are very difficult. I've represented domestic abuse victims individually, and they're very challenging.
Bonnie, I'm so glad you called, and I appreciate the perspective of a therapist, and thank you for your question. We'll go to Todd in Mount Horeb next. Todd, good morning.
Good morning. I've been with Amy now for over 30 years. She is a source of income. I work, not anymore, but the question I have is, I've helped her raise a family or a daughter, and we're both getting older, and now there's medical questions coming up. And I'm just wondering if I have any legal say in Amy's, with Amy. And
Are we talking about divorce here, Todd, or are we talking about ongoing marriage and the powers of each spouse?
No. We're not talking about divorce. But okay. There's medical questions coming up, and we're both getting older.
Yeah.
Just to be able to advocate for it, do I have any, like, legal standing?
Well, here's a little a little family law that goes beyond divorce and legal separation. Paul, is this something that you can handle?
I'm not sure I have enough to answer the question.
Yeah.
If he's married to Amy and talking about their minor child?
No, they're talking about the medical issues that arise now that they're aging, now that they're getting older. Who makes medical decisions here, and who?
For each other.
Yeah, this sounds maybe more like power of attorney sort of thing.
Yes. Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Yeah, and that's a big push in the law to address what we call advanced directives, which includes something you mentioned, Lee, power of attorney for healthcare. There are other tools that lawyers can help folks with in terms of those things. So power of attorney for healthcare is a really good one, right? Because, it authorizes someone else, presumably your spouse, to make decisions, medical decisions on your behalf. And I know one thing that's really good about that is just talking to your spouse and your family members. What would you want if you were in a coma, and depending on the circumstances? So, working on that advanced directives is a great idea.
So in Todd's case, it sounds like it might be a common law marriage. First of all, what does that mean, and how does that play a role in these decisions?
Ooh, so common law marriage, just that term that you've thrown out, Lee,
yeah,
is the idea that, right, if people present themselves as, or sometimes the law says, hold themselves out as husband and wife long enough, they'll be considered married. We don't have common law marriage in Wisconsin. So
okay.
If you haven't gone through the official steps laid out by Wisconsin statute, then you're not considered married, but you could certainly grant, power to another person, your lifetime partner, through a power of attorney for healthcare.
With a couple minutes we have left here, actually just over a minute here, Paul, I'm also curious about how remarriage plays into these decisions about divorce and family law.
Yeah, certainly a lot there, a lot to consider. Maybe the one thing I would say from a legal point of view is to think about a prenuptial agreement. If you want to be protective of assets that you're bringing into a second relationship, and also estate planning, right? That can be very sensitive for adult children. Wait a minute, my mother or my father is getting remarried, and now there's a step parent in the picture, and the adult children are thinking about, okay, what does this mean for estate planning and those things down the road? So good to give those some thought and connect with a lawyer to learn about your choices.
Really appreciate your perspective, your understanding of family law in Wisconsin, and your sense of zen, Paul. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you, Lee.
We'll have to do this again. Paul Stenzel, family law attorney and mediator with a family Milwaukee law firm Hansen and Hildebrand, and also affiliated and working with the Family Mediation Center in Milwaukee. When we continue, the new edition of Big River Magazine is out now, and we'll catch up with its editor, Reggie McLeod. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry Mueller today, and you're listening to The Larry Mueller Show.